everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very much for being so doggone good looking. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out to Jeff at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. Today's warm-up song is going to be Voodoo Child, brought to you by Jimi Hendrix from The Experience. I actually used to have that LP, that record. It was my mom's from the 60s, and I had this record player. I was a teenager, and my mom was like, oh, I've got all these old records. Like, you can have them if you want. There was, like, Beatles and Crosby, Stills, and Nash and, like, Creedence Clearwater Revival, like, all these great old artists from the 60s. And I had that LP sitting on that record player for a long time. I put it in storage, completely forgot about it. And then when I got to it a few years later, the record was all warped and everything from the heat. So I completely destroyed my Jimi Hendrix LP. So for any of you keeping track at home on my Christmas wish list, I would like to replace that one. Thank you in advance. Special thank you to all the Buy Me a Coffee folks. And guys, I seriously, truly could not do this without you. There are web hosting fees and software and mics and cables and laptops and cameras and just so much stuff. It just never ends. And I think maybe in about a year or two, I might break even on everything I put into it. So it means so much for you guys and your contributions and everything. So I'm going to go through. I believe I have successfully consolidated the entire list. If I missed you, please let me know. But here we go. Jen from Massachusetts, Rick from Manitoba, Wyatt, also from Manitoba, Elizabeth, Michael, Andrew, Airborne Scott, stand up, hook up, shuffle to the door, jump right out, yell Signal Corps, Tony, Amanda, Mike from Wisconsin, Joe the Nooch, Jay from Indiana, Aaron from Indiana, Sherry, also from Indiana, thank you to the Indiana crew, Michelle from Virginia, Hunter, Joe from Pennsylvania, Chris from New York, Kate C., and Bex from the UK. We also have a few folks donating directly through the podcast host, so DJ, my brother down in the south there, Melissa, Amy, and Mike from Wisconsin again, who double dips, but it is my part-time job for some commercial bee consulting, little inside joke with him there. And of course, special thank you to Ryan and JT, the very handsome and well-groomed moderators of our Discord server. And like I said before, please let me know if I missed you, because I can't do it without you guys. Now, happy spring, everybody. I know you're excited. I'm excited too. It is finally spring. It's here. We've been waiting forever. The long cold winter, or at least the worst of it, should be over if you are now in the southern hemisphere. So congrats to all of the Beekeeping for Newbies family out there in Australia. Good day to all of you, and keep an eye out for those swarms. It's going to be a busy one, and try not to take any one-way trips to Swarmville this spring. Okay, so today we are going to talk about overwintering and condensation and a bunch of different things around that, because when the bees overwinter in a tree cavity, they've already designed and figured out the perfect setup for surviving those cold winter months. We stick them in a Langstroth hive or a similar type of setup, and we kind of think that it's the same thing. And there are a lot of reasons why they are incredibly different. So we're going to compare some of those differences. We're going to talk about how natural cavities manage heat, water, carbon dioxide, what we need to do as far as how that plays into your winter preps. When you're working with, of course, with traditional hives. Now, I do want to start off with a quick mention about my all-season inner cover. You've heard me talk about this. I used to call it the vented inner cover because I couldn't remember what it was called, but it is from Honey Run Apiaries, which you guys, by the way, need to get me. If you're listening from Honey Run Apiaries, you guys need to get me an affiliate code here because I refer a lot of people to you. They've probably sold hundreds of these. But anyway, the all-season inner cover, it is a component that is goes at the top of the hive. So whatever your hive configuration is, a couple of deeps, mediums, whatever it might be, in place of a regular inner cover, you'll put this on top. And it's roughly about 3 inches high. It's got a couple of vents on the front, back, and then, you know, a few more on the sides. And those vents are covered with number 8 hardware cloth, so, you know, no bees can get in or out. Other insects aren't coming in. In the spring, summertime, that cavity is completely open, but just like an inner cover where it sort of has that little handle in the middle, it has the exact same thing in this, but you cover it up with a piece of hardware cloth. You can just staple it in place. Just 2 staples, one on each corner diagonally, is fine, and that keeps the bees from going up into that space. Now, what this allows is for air to flow in, up, and then out. Now, there are a lot of discussions around whether or not it's necessary. You know, you don't need top airflow. You do need top airflow. You got to have airflow. You don't need it. People argue about anything. If there's something to argue about, people are going to find a reason to argue about it. Now, for the longest time, you heard me say over and over again, what's in the tree? What are they doing in the tree? How is the tree configured? So we're going to get back to that. But for this inner cover, here is what I've observed. I think I almost described it wrong. I think I maybe didn't convey how it works or why it was as effective as it is in the past. So I'm going to try to hopefully right the ship a little bit here. In the spring, a lot of times we will move over to, you know, the all season inner cover and then a screened bottom board. So now we've got this opportunity where air can move up from the bottom and out the top and create some circulation. Now, one argument to this is, look, bees have a system in place with which they use to cool the hive. They use water in the hive, and through the water and fanning, they are able to cool the hive. By adding all of this excess, you know, ventilation, you're it's kind of like having the air conditioner on in your home with the windows open. That's what some people will tell you. What I have informally, non-scientifically observed is that with a screened bottom board and this all-season inner cover, I see less bearding, which to me, you know, bearding in of itself is not an issue. Bees beard, it's, you know, it's not going to hurt anything. There are more bees outside. They are not protected, you know, because they're not in the hive. They're not working in the hive, doing inside the hive tasks because it's too hot and there are too many bees in there. So getting bees out of the hive reduces the heat. So to me, there could be an impact to productivity by there being all these bees outside. Again, I haven't done a scientific study, so I can't tell you for sure. But I believe that we want the bees to be inside the hive as much as possible. I think this all-season cover combined with the screened bottom board works really well. Even if you don't do the screened bottom board, just having that all-season inner cover with that ventilation up top, I believe that also makes a big difference just by itself. I think what really has a big impact to all of this discussion is the overall size of the colony. I've had a lot of colonies like in a single deep or maybe even like a couple of mediums if you're using a medium, you know, a couple of medium type config where they're perfectly fine. They're content. They're not bearding. And you've got maybe a cloth inner cover. Like there's the top is completely sealed. And there's nothing in no air getting out of the top. And they do perfectly well with that. So when somebody tells you like you have to have the all-season inner cover, you have to have a regular traditional inner cover with a vent in the top, Mylar cover, a canvas cover, like it, all of those things, I've used some combination or variants of all of them and they all work. I just think that there are certain subtle things that you can do from time to time to maybe make things a little bit better. That's why I like the all-season inner cover. I've said it a million times and I'll keep saying it. I do not like any scenario with which you open up the outer cover using coins or popsicle sticks or whatever, because a lot of people think, oh yeah, it's going to let air out. This is great. And then you're also letting all these bugs and things in, wax moth. They can get a real low profile, climb in and sneak into places. Hive beetles and things can walk right in. I think that's a bad idea, but I'm getting off track because I have ADD. Now in the wintertime, the only thing that I do differently with the all season inner cover is I take a piece of foam insulation. When you buy it, it comes with the insulation. It's a 2-inch block. You just drop that block into the top, and then it has a center section that goes right over where the hardware cloth is that covers up that kind of that handle on the inside. And then you just put an outer cover on the outside of that and you're done. Whether it's telescoping or migratory, doesn't matter. Cover it up and you're done. That has been tremendously effective for me in all seasons. But we're going to talk a little bit more about why that's effective, or at least why I think it's effective. So let's talk about generically, like how the bees are going to survive the winter. I think there's an area that I feel like sometimes I struggle when I'm talking to all of you, because we've done all these episodes in the past and I've said, well, if you start from the beginning and you just go all the way to where we are now, you should have most of the information that you need. I see some challenges with it. One of them is some of the information has changed. Like my personal Varroa management strategy has changed since I was talking about Varroa, you know, 2-3 years ago. There are some things I'm doing differently now with that. But It was also a little more painful. I do apologize for anybody who's had to listen to some of those earlier episodes. I listened to some of the things. I'm like, what? Get to the point, man. What are you doing? So anyway, I do apologize on that one. But I don't want to keep being redundant too, like saying the same things over and over. So it's hard to find a balance between new information and old information. So some of this is going to be a review and some of it will hopefully be new. But the way that the bees as a colony survive over the winter in cooler scenarios, imagine what you see on a tree if you've ever seen a picture of a swarm. They form this big ball, this cluster on the tree. That's kind of what it looks like inside the hive. They will cluster together. They will move into the cells, and they will form this big unit, this big cluster of bees. And what they do is that, of course, just proximity alone will help with temperature, but they also will move and vibrate. They use the same muscles of their body that they use for flight. They use them by contracting those muscles. They use them to generate heat. Now, the amount of heat that they're generating is going to be really dictated by, you know, the overall temperature. They will try and what they're doing in the hive. The mantle, the kind of outer edge of that cluster, tends to be, you know, somewhere in that like 50 degree Fahrenheit, 10 degree Celsius kind of range. The middle will be anywhere between 70, 75, and, you know, during normal, you know, normal scenarios or situations. But if they are raising brood, brood has a much higher temperature requirement, which would be around 95 Fahrenheit, so around 35 Celsius. So they will generate more heat and use more resources if they are caring for and raising brood. This becomes particularly important when you get to the end of the winter and they're going into the spring and you still have, it's still cold out and they're starting to detect some trace amounts of some spring pollens that are out there. Things are starting to pop up a little bit. It's getting warm enough for them to start flying and they're going to ramp up and start raising a lot of brood. So here we are at the end of the season. They're running out of their winter resources. They've lost bees that have just died from age. And now you have these winter bees that are, this is a really, really critical time for bee survival. We've talked about this a lot because now they've got to raise that temperature up even more to raise the new brood. And they're using resources to feed the new brood and to make royal jelly. And to, there's just a lot going on that requires a lot of late season resources. Now, as a kind of offshoot, so just like humans, we breathe in oxygen and we exhale carbon dioxide mostly. Bees are the exact same way. What's really kind of cool is they're inside of their space, whatever their space and their cavity might be, they're all in very close proximity to one another. And because of that, there's actually an increase in the CO2. There's a kind of a buildup of it. And this is kind of a bad thing for people. You know, you get a bunch of people in a room and carbon dioxide levels go up. That means we have lower oxygen levels. People start getting lightheaded, dizzy, headaches, all that kind of stuff. But the bees, it's really actually a very natural part of their survival. It helps to kind of get them into a mellow kind of zen type state where they're more relaxed and they're calmer. They're less active. They're using less energy. They're consuming less food. So there is an important aspect of this when we talk about how, you know, how much of an opening to have in the wintertime, right? I always tell people like, yeah, just go down and put that 3/4 inch to 1.5 inch kind of range opening, and that's really all they need. You go wide open with that and you bring in a lot of air. It's not just more cool air coming in, but it's a higher concentration of oxygen, which then means less CO2, which then means less of their ability to get into this kind of mellow state. And so again, they can go, for humans, I think it's like 5%. If you get to a CO2 level in an area that's 5% or higher, that's very detrimental for people. But bees can go up to 8%, which this also plays into. And again, I don't know that there's a formal study. I need to do some research to see, but I have heard that varroa mites cannot tolerate those higher levels of CO2. So while you have the bees clustered and they're surviving, just doing their thing, mellowed out and getting through the winter, those diminished oxygen levels, increased CO2, the mites have trouble surviving that. So that's kind of a really interesting thing I definitely want to learn more about, but it's kind of a little fun fact. And then, of course, the cluster will move through the hive and through the resources of the hive throughout the winter, consuming, you know, what it needs as it moves around. And that's going to be the same whether it's in a tree, whether it's in a Langstroth hive or wherever. They're still going to move around. Now, we probably would want to have a separate discussion around how things are managed in a horizontal hive. I think overwintering is a really... could propose some really interesting challenges for that horizontal hive, but we'll maybe cover that another time. Eating healthy can feel like a chore sometimes, right? But I've found something that makes it easy and delicious. Washington Red Raspberries. These aren't just any frozen berries. They're grown by family farmers in Washington State, picked at peak ripeness and frozen within hours to lock in nutrients. We're talking fiber, antioxidants, vitamin C, real nutrition with no added sugar, just fruit as nature intended. I toss them into smoothies, stir them into yogurt, and even top my oatmeal with them. They're so fresh and full of flavor, I actually look forward to eating healthier. And honestly, it feels so good knowing I'm supporting American family farms every time I grab a bag, and you'll know they're grown right here in the U.S. because it says so on the package. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at Costco, Kroger, Meijer, and Winco Foods. Look for them in Kirkland's Three Berry Blend, Smucker's Raspberry Jam, Peanut Butter and Raspberry Uncrustables, or those True Fruit chocolate-covered raspberries I can't stop snacking on. Want recipes, tips, or to see all the places you can find them? Go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
I want to talk now about insulation and insulation R values within both a traditional hive, Langstroth specifically, as well as, you know, within a tree. In a Langstroth hive, typically these are mostly pine. They're like 5/8 of an inch, maybe 3/4 of an inch pine, something like that. And the R value of, you know, the components of a beehive are typically somewhere around like 0.75, like 3/4 of one R value. So when I say R value, I'm talking about like insulation, you know, the ability to hold and retain heat. So it's just like, you know, if you have, I'm not even going to try to guess here. I can't remember the numbers, but I know that if you, you know, you put insulation in walls, like the bats of insulation, I think that might be like R4, R6, something like that. When you're up in an attic space and you're trying to fill in the trusses and you want to have a big buffer, you might be using like an R24 or an R40. I don't know. I just know that the bigger the number, the more insulation that you're getting. And that's critically important when it comes to beehives because, this, like I said, the sides and the bottom of the hive combined are going to give up about 25% of the heat. About 75% of the heat loss in a Langstroth hive is going to come from the top. So that's a big deal, and that's really important. Now, in a tree, on average, when you know, trees have been cut open and evaluated, when bees have, you know, had a colony inside of a tree, the average thickness of the walls in those tree cavities comes out to around 4 inches. So it's roughly, you know, an R value of about 4. That's on the sides. Now, on the top and the bottom, it's infinite, basically. You have complete huge tree going up, big piece of tree going down. I mean, this is typically occurring somewhere between like 15 and 40 feet up in a tree. So you've got a lot of tree above and below. So you're only really losing energy or heat from the sides. Now, another thing to remember is people always say, oh, we got to have a top ventilation. We got to have a vent in the top of the hive. The all-season inner cover I told you about, it comes with a top vent, and I cover it up. In the wintertime, I keep it covered. And in the spring, I leave it open, but I put hardware cloth over it so that air can flow out of it, but bees are not coming in and out. I don't like to have a top entrance. It's another area to defend. And it's there aren't usually a lot of bees kind of allocated and dedicated to, you know, defense and guarding. And it's more space to cover. It's just too much for robbers or other bugs, insects, and things to get in. It's not really not something I do. But in a tree cavity, when the bees are scouting and they're looking for things and they're taking their measurements and trying to figure out what they want, they're going to be, they want that. I'll tell you, well, let's dive in a little bit and talk more about the specifics of what they want in a cavity. So they're going to want a single entrance, usually in the lower one third of that cavity. If there are other entrances and other holes, that's fine. They'll just propolize those shut. But what they do is they have this ability, which is pretty fascinating, where they can move around through a space and they can essentially measure that space. And I don't know exactly what the mechanism is within their minds and bodies that does this, but it's really cool. And they'll walk around and map it out and figure out, okay, this is about the size we need. Now, what they're trying to look for, based on what bees have had a preference towards, you know, throughout research, is a cavity that is about 40 liters. Now, what's kind of interesting and fascinating with this is most, like a single deep, like if you look at a single Langstroth hive deep, that is roughly about 40 liters. And this is the space that bees would look for when they're establishing a new hive location. So that's kind of fascinating because we always have two deeps and multiple mediums and we have all these extra resources and everything is stacked up, which kind of begs the question, like, why do our hives have to have so much and theirs don't? Well, one piece of that is we're trying to take a bunch of honey for ourselves. So we need to give them more room to make honey so that we can take it and keep some for ourselves. But the Langstroth hives don't have the level of insulation that the natural cavity in the tree does. So we talked about the entrance. Now the entrance at that lower third is roughly about an inch and a quarter, you know, a little over 3 centimeters. And that's, again, the size they prefer. If it's bigger than that, it's fine. They'll just propolize all around it until it gets to the size they want. Now, moisture and condensation are an important topic that we discuss a lot. And you've heard me say a million times, wet bees are dead bees. But the bees still need that moisture. This is where it becomes really different. Because in the tree, where you have all of this insulation surrounding everything in the single entrance, when that cooler air comes in through the entrance, it now starts to work its way up in at the bottom of the cavity. And then, of course, up top, you have all of the heat that's being generated by the bees. The actual honey will absorb a certain amount of heat and provide a little bit of insulation itself, which is pretty wild, right? Like the edge pieces of honey that are closest to the side walls will actually absorb and hold a little bit of heat and provide additional insulation. Pretty crazy. But now you have all of that heat in the top and there's cool air coming in at the bottom. Now, when those two air masses basically come together, it's just like within, you know, within the atmosphere, when you have a warm air mass and a cool air mass comes together, whatever the dew point temperature is, that's the point with which moisture is created, where condensation will occur. Inside of this cavity, when you have those two warmer and cooler air coming together and that condensation is created, in the cavity, it tends to occur well below the cluster of bees. That is exactly how it's supposed to happen. Then it can then drip down and end up in the bottom of the cavity. So the bees can actually walk down to the bottom of the cavity, and where the water, the condensation has pulled up in the bottom, they can then go and retrieve that and consume that. And it was actually discovered through research at one point in time that I think it was Tom Seeley that had found that he found a cavity where it looked like the bees had actually chewed some of the wood down below to make a little pool and reservoir, kind of propolized it all shut, kind of like a collecting pond, like a holding tank for all of this moisture. Because, you know, water is an absolute critical component to bees, just like other organisms. We have to have water to survive, and bees are no different. And in addition to, you know, the water that comes in that is a part of or a byproduct of that condensation, they are also, for every gram of honey that they consume, they are going to release almost like about two-thirds of a gram, 0.68 roughly grams of water will be released. The colony through that and through respiration, just like people, we breathe air in, we let out carbon dioxide, but there's also a little bit of moisture and kind of vapor that comes out in through respiration. A colony can generate 3 to 5 grams of water per hour, which comes out to be about a liter a month. So if you look at over the period of, say, a 5-month, you know, winter, you may end up with 4 or 5 liters of water that are created, over a gallon of water created just through regular respiration and, you know, like off-gassing from consumption of food and energy being burned and all of that. So that combined with the condensation provides water that the bees need to survive. So it's a really cool thing. But when I say wet bees are dead bees, remember, as I just discussed, that moisture, because of the configuration of the cavity, the moisture is dropping down to the bottom, not on top of the bees. And the way that we have quite often set up our hives, we, especially if you're using a top entrance in the wintertime, cool air coming in at the top is hitting the hot air that the bees have in there, and then it's dripping down on them at the top. Or you have too wide of an entrance, or the insulation is just really, really poor, and there's too much radiant cool air, which is also doing the exact same thing. I mean, think about a window that you would see. If you had like a single pane window and you crank the heat up in the house and it's, you know, 0 degrees Celsius, 32 Fahrenheit outside, you're going to get condensation on that window on the inside. It's the exact same thing. So how do you combat that? How do you make that Langstroth hive be more like, you know, what you would see in the tree? Since we know that about 75% of the heat is lost through the top, most important thing, you've got to have some kind of a top insulation. Now, you'll hear a lot of people talk a lot about quilt boxes. Now, a lot of bee terminology is, you know, people will say one thing and it has 20 different meanings to other people. I've heard a quilt box can be like a material, like a lots of canvas that's put into an area just to fill a void space. Pine shavings like you would use for a hamster or a rabbit or something like that. Actual like insulation, like an insulation type of material. If you have some of that, you put it in something and fill that cavity with that. I've heard lots of different ways that people use to insulate the top. The most important piece of all of that, whatever you use, one, make sure that it's chemically safe to not, you know, so that you can have it around the bees without causing any damage, harm, or anything that's unhealthy to them. But also make sure that it doesn't get wet. Once insulation becomes soaking wet with moisture, it loses its ability to retain heat. So you've got to keep it dry. That's going to be really important. So number one, insulate the top. Now, where you are is going to kind of dictate exactly how much insulation that you're going to need. But like I said, mine is about 2 inches. I have a 2-inch insulation block on mine. I think if I were in an area that was much cooler, I might do 4 to 6 inch block. It's not going to hurt at all. I mean, you could take an entire deep and put it on the top of your hive and fill that entire thing up, you know, the entire cavity with foam block and completely seal it off. And that would provide massive insulation on the top. If you wanted to, you could take a deep down at the bottom, have no entrance. Just put that deep down flat on the ground, fill that with, fill that cavity with foam insulation, cut a block or multiple blocks that are the exact size to fill the whole thing. Now you've got complete insulation from the bottom, complete insulation up at the top. Now the sides are a challenge. You're looking at sub one, like less than 1 R if you're just using the regular pine boxes, but this is where people go with the wraps. So you can put, you know, the roofing paper is not going to give you a whole lot. I think all you're getting out of that is some radiant heat, and maybe you're filling in cracks where the hive bodies meet each other if they were disturbed, you know, at a time when they could not repropolize everything back together. That might help for that. But they also have some that have a layer of insulation either in between them or in the inner layer. You can wrap that. I think I would be trying to get it close to the tree in that R4 kind of category. And of course, there are specialty hives that are made by various people, you know, in different parts of the world where you can buy. And they're from what I understand, they're a little bit pricey. But if you can overwinter, you know, an entire colony of bees in one box that would be the equivalent of a single deep, maybe you pay 2 or 3 times as much for it, but your overwintering likelihood is significantly higher. The amount of money you have to spend to feed them is much less because you don't have to build up as many resources. If you're only treating with, for Varroa, one brood box, basically, you're cutting down on how much it costs to treat. So there's a lot of reasons why trying to make a hive configuration of some sort that mimics as closely as possible to what is in the wild and what that cavity looks like, I think that makes a lot of sense. Okay, as we start to wrap up here, I want to just do a quick recap, right? The natural cavity needs to be your blueprint. So thick insulation, the top is the most important. We need a single entrance down low, right? About anywhere from about 1/4 inch plus or minus 1/2 inch or so is probably going to be really good. Condensation inside the hive is fine. Remember, the wet bees are dead bees when it's dropping on top of them. Don't let that hot air at the top meet with cool air at the top. You want all hot, warm air at the top, and then let that condensation drip down and let them consume it from somewhere else. So thick insulation on the top is the most important. If you can wrap the sides, get something on the sides as well, even better if your environment needs that. And I think that when you take time to look at it and you really understand what's going on in the tree and you understand what bees do in that tree, it'll help you make some smarter choices and decisions around how you set the hives up. Now, I do have a couple of questions that popped up at the end of the day yesterday at some point in the last day or two when I mentioned that I was going to be talking about this. Question here, it says, overwintering hive box configuration, number of deeps and mediums. Well, like we just discussed, the bees are looking for a cavity if they're swarming that's about 40 liters or one deep. So if you create the right environment for them that mimics the tree, then the answer is probably going to be you're going to need to have a deep. Now, there are a lot of people that don't have that configuration. They're in Langstroth setups, and they might stack single deeps four high and just have one colony on top of another to overwinter. And they stick them side by side, and they do divided deeps with one colony on each side and four frame nukes going up. There's lots of different ways you can configure things. I would be looking towards, you know, what are people in your area doing? And, you know, what I can't, it's hard for me to give specific local advice to you as to how many of each that you'll need, but the more insulated and the less energy that has to be produced to keep the bees warm, the less resources they're going to need, et cetera. I know that doesn't really answer the question, but it kind of goes to that, the standard answer of beekeeping, that depends. How and when to consolidate down to the winter configuration. So they have in parentheses here, signs like drones being expelled, temperature change, et cetera. I don't, for the drone part, I don't even pay attention. I don't care. Like I want to see drone brood in the spring, but that drone brood's not for me anyway. Right. So my queens in my apiary aren't mating with my drones. The queens will tend to fly further away than the drones will. They're mating with someone else's drones. So while I want to have drones out there to hopefully support other queens in other places or whatever, I don't care about drones. Don't pay attention to them. They're great for figuring if you want to do some varroa mite checks in the spring. You know, varroa loves drone brood. So that's kind of what I use drones for the most part. But I don't pay attention to when they're expelled or what, you know, that doesn't matter to me. Temperature changes, I don't really watch. What I'm paying attention to is as those winter bees are being reared and you see the explosion and increase, or I should say increase, not necessarily an explosion like you would see in the spring, but when you see the increase in brood production, that's when you say, okay, I see things are ramping up. You then see a tapering of that. As that tapering begins, you definitely don't want to be adding new space, because when they start tapering, that's when, if they're still bringing resources in, they can then go ahead and backfill into the brood area or areas of brood that have been used for brood recently. And, you know, they would much rather do that than to be trying to draw out comb and make more usable space. It's very resource intensive. As far as when to consolidate things go, one thing I would tell you with consolidation, unless you know really, really well what things go where, try not to start mixing things up too much. The general kind of rule you want to stay with is you want to keep your brood in the middle. You want honey to the top and maybe to the outsides a little bit. And when I say outsides, you know, let's say you have an 8-frame setup. In the bottom, let's just say that all 6 of the bottom middle frames are all brood, and you might have, maybe you'll have a honey frame on the edge of each of those, maybe not. You go up to the next box and you probably have anywhere between maybe 1 and 3 frames of brood in the middle, all honey on the outside of that. Maybe a medium up on top of that that's all honey. But again, keeping the brood to the middle, right? That's the maximum way to, or the best way to maximize the protection of and the ease of protecting brood is to have them in the center of everything, surrounded by honey. You start mixing, matching, moving things around. If it's not where they like it, they are going to want to move it somewhere else. Again, a lot of resources are going to be needed for them and time and energy to move things where they want them. So try not to move things around too much from what they have. If you don't know, if you're like, gosh, I really don't know how these should be aligned, go back to your notes. If you're not taking those notes, start taking those notes so that you know and you can track. Okay, well, I've tracked this colony or these 5 colonies for the past 2 years. They always seem to have this many of this here and this many of that there. So I'm going to replicate that in my going into the winter configuration. I always want maximum honey space. That's kind of my preferred, or I want maximum honey. I want as much honey as I possibly can. If I were in a situation where I had, let's say, a medium up top and I had maybe 2 frames that had nothing in them, and I had two frames of honey in my freezer that was just surplus honey, I would rather have those two frames of honey out of the freezer and in there as extra in case they need it versus two empty frames. If I had four frames of honey, I would rather keep the four frames of honey in there versus trying to consolidate and removing the box. Yes, that box is an additional cavity. It is additional space that has to be heated. But you can also consider using what they call a follower board or just something to basically fill the cavity. Like they use blocks. Some places have actual blocks that are two, three, four frames wide. And you drop the block in and it has a hanger just like a frame would. And it fills the space. It fills the cavity. Again, that would be awesome if you had an 8-frame setup or whatever it is, 8 or 10 frame, doesn't matter. Let's say you have 3 viable honey frames that you want in there. Then you put your 3 frames in the middle and then put 2 3-frame frame spacers on the outsides or whatever the math comes out to be that makes the most sense. But using a follower board or a spacer or something that fills that cavity and fills that void is a way to kind of help manage that surplus space. So then you get into that balancing act between when is it better for me to remove the extra hive body so it's less space to heat, but also recognizing I'm maybe taking 2 frames of honey. I would say I would rather have the 2 frames of honey, even if I had to fill up frames of drawn comb throughout the rest of the space, at least I'm putting something in the space. And then it asks for like overwintering nuggets of wisdom. I don't know if I have those. I apologize for that. I think that, you know, it's don't mess with them. This is another area where it kind of gets to be an individual decision. I close the hive up in pretty much like October timeframe, mid-October. Probably the last time I get into the hives. Maybe if a colony is light and I specifically know that a colony or group of colonies are light, I might continue feeding a little bit longer, maybe even into late October, early November. But once I close up, I don't open the hive. November, December, January, I don't touch them. The first warm day in February, I will try to take a peek and see where they are within the cluster. Now that's going to change because I am going to be doing it this. I'm starting this project this winter. I'll probably start in October or November timeframe. And I'm going to be putting together a device that's going to operate a bunch of sensors with temperature on them, and it'll run these probes throughout the entire. I'm going to do it on a mock hive. I'm going to have an actual hive set up and have the temperature sensors in just to see how they're gathering and see how everything is working and verify that the charging of the solar panel and all that stuff is working. And then by next season, I'll have it in a live hive. I'll be monitoring temperature all season, and then I'll be doing that over the winter as well. Of next year. So a year from now, we'll start to get a real test on what it's like to overwinter. But being able to monitor those temperatures and know exactly where the cluster is, have it set up to tie into a heat map. So the heat map will show me, you know, basically based on heat, exactly where the cluster is. That's going to be really cool, you know, fun and exciting. But in the absence of that, you know, of course, you just have to just take a peek in there. Some people are in the hives every single day that it gets above 50 degrees, they're opening the hive. I don't do that. I don't like to introduce the cold. And the reality is there's nothing I'm going to do to solve the problem. I focus and devote a lot of time and energy to having the right genetics that overwinter. And I've said this a million times, but I'm going to keep saying it because it's one of the most important things to me. People put so much stuff in their hives over the winter and I don't understand it, like candy boards and fondant and all this kind of stuff. Like, I don't do that. And you don't have to do that. But you do have, there is an animal husbandry component of things. You are the beekeeper. These are your managed beehives, and you are responsible for their well-being. So if you have to figure out a feeding solution that works, that they actually will consume, and it is the right food for them at the right time of year, then you do what you got to do. Like I said, that's why I do that in February. I open up in February. If the bees haven't made it to February, then I probably don't need those genetics. If they can make it to February, I don't mind giving them a little bit of a hand in February because, again, it's a really, really tricky, critical kind of month with a lot of brood rearing getting ready to happen. And, you know, like a pollen patty of some sort is usually probably a good go-to for that for a lot of people. Overwintering do's and don'ts. This says baseboards on metal / concrete, moisture barriers, wrapping. We talked about some of that. I think that getting the hive, you don't want radiant heat coming from the cold ground up or cold air flowing below. But I also think that the hive being lower to the ground in the winter could definitely reduce some of that cold air from coming up. So I think if there was a way to have maybe a pallet And then on top of the pallet, you had a piece of plywood or something solid. And then you had an insulated board that was below that, maybe a 4-inch piece of foam insulation inside of a hive body or something. You know, these are new things I'm just talking about that I think I want to experiment with myself. But I think creating a gap underneath is great to complement your top insulation. But the top insulation is going to have to happen. The moisture barriers, I think this is going to be in line with like what we talked about with wrapping, you know, wrapping it with roofing paper or whatever. If you are in an area that has deep snow and you're going to have snow coming up over and around the hives, that would be a really ideal scenario where if you had nothing else planned to put on the outside of those hives, yes, I think definitely having some roofing paper around to prevent moisture, that definitely makes a lot of sense. All right, everybody, I have this feeling that I'm going to start rambling and I'm not going to ever stop here. So I hope that this was useful. I think it's a really fascinating subject. It's something I want to do more with. I want to find a tree like the one outside. I have a cedar at my house here that's like 150 years old or whatever. I really want to cut it down because there's that hive that swarmed this past summer. It went right. They were scouting my swarm traps and they were like, we're going to go to the tree. But I would love to be able to, I'm not going to destroy this tree, but I would love to be able to get in there and just cut it apart and see what it looks like in there. And just, you know, apparently if a swarm makes it to a tree and they survive that first winter, they have like an 80% likelihood of survival beyond that, which is pretty cool. Kind of a fascinating little statistic there. But I hope that this is useful and valuable information to you. Like I said, it's a fun, exciting topic. And feel free to check us out over at bestbeekeepinggear.com. I'm not doing a lot of gear reviews right now, but there's a lot of introductory Varroa information in there and some treatment methods and approaches and a couple of how-tos. And you know, we'll be ramping that stuff up over the next couple of years. YouTube.com/@beekeepingfornewbies. You can listen to the podcast there. We got a couple of videos here and there about different things. One of them is how much it costs, how expensive is beekeeping. That's a good one to check out. A lot of people getting into beekeeping and they're like, oh, cool, this will be a fun little hobby. And then like $3,000 or $4,000 later, they're like, what just happened to my wallet, my checkbook, my account? So definitely one worth checking out. Feel free to join us over there at beekeepingfornewbies.com. We got a link to the Discord room there, and you can come chat with other beekeepers all over the world. But that's all I've got for you today. So take care, be kind to one another, and remember that I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.